The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
What we are seeing is that we're in the midst of a dramatic revolution. Things are changing. Technology's changing. The economy's changing in dramatic ways. People are scared. And political leaders in both political parties have largely abdicated their responsibility to give context to the nature of the change. Again, Philip Zelikow's written a lot about how the economy's changing and how political leaders have failed to grab onto this. Let me just offer that the Peterson Institute for International Trade did a survey that only 15% of American jobs lost in the last 17 years have been lost to trade. 85% of them are lost to innovation and technology change. And yet both political parties had as a central component of their electoral platform opposition to trade. That's the measure of how we as elites and as experts have failed in our responsibility to educate the public and to shape political party attitudes.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 28th, 2017. That's the voice of Corey Shockey of the Hoover Institution, former official in the National Security Council, the Defense Department, and the State Department, speaking the other night at the launch event of the Texas National Security Journal. The journal is a collaboration between the University of Texas and War on the Rocks, and this podcast is the first joint podcast between War on the Rocks and Lawfare. Corey joined War on the Rocks editor-in-chief Ryan Evans, defense policy analyst at American University Nora Ben-Sahel, and none other than me. Ryan Evans moderated the event, which covered how other countries are responding and should respond to the Trump administration, the relationship between the domestic order and the international order, and whether we should be optimistic or gloomy 10 months into the new regime. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 256, The Revenge of the Blob.
So anyway, we got a nice bipartisan panel talking about how people that do what we all do for a living have adjusted to the age of Trump. I first want to start with Ben at the other end. Ben and I were talking a little earlier. I mean, Lawfare has been respected for years as this sort of authoritative source on the intersection of law and national security. But it also spoke to a very sort of specific community of people. And the ascendance of Donald Trump has changed all that. And I just wanted to hear more about that story.
Well, first of all, your check's in the mail for asking that question. No, it's taken us, you know, or me anyway, completely by surprise. And I guess the first element of it was that, you know, we had this very devoted readership. We always used to joke that we had 100% penetration of a very discreet and known group of people. And we've always made a point of never collecting data on the readership because of the nature of the readership. We don't want to have to try to protect that data, and, you know, it would be a target, and we don't want to create that environment in which But we don't need to collect data on the readership because we know it really intimately. And what happened this year, starting last year, was that the audience really broke through into a mass audience for the first time. And we started reaching, it's in the tens of millions. We've had 12 million people on the site this year. And we don't really know who they are. It seems to be a group of people that, unlike our traditional audience, is left-leaning. It seems like it is not a group of people who are, at least didn't previously think they were interested in the intersection of national security law and policy. And they are deeply animated by anxiety about the Trump administration. And, to some extent, that is just a function of the fact that we've done a lot of writing in that space. But to some extent, I think it is a deeper function of the fact that, large numbers of people see all of a sudden a set of questions in the current administration about, that ask very deep questions about what is it that threatens us and what is the nature of a term like national security, and what is the role of law in conditioning it. And so it's actually been a fascinating element of the last year and a half, that large numbers of people who are completely outside of our core audience have gravitated to the site for the first time. And the irony is, so we always used to say we had 100% penetration of a very small audience, and now we have 100% penetration of a very small audience and 12 million other people who kind of showed up to watch. It's a real challenge to try to serve both readerships simultaneously.
And just to pick up on that even more, one thing I've heard you say before is the nature of the debates that you've been having have changed. In addition to having these new audiences, is you were arguing against different people before this administration, or even before the campaign.
I mean, so first of all, there is no we, right, in the sense that Lawfare does not have editorial positions. We've never asked anybody what their politics are before bringing them on to write for the site. But there was a center of gravity of people associated with Lawfare, and I was certainly one of them, who got involved in writing in this area in part because we did not accept a certain civil liberties and human rights orthodoxy. And so there was a period of the site's early development where a lot of the debates we were engaged with, whether it was Guantanamo or surveillance authorities or drone strikes, were a lot of people on Lawfare were making arguments that were not the orthodox positions, or arguing with the orthodoxies of the human rights community and the civil liberties community. And so as a result of that, to the extent that we were part of the public mind at all, we were sort of thought of as the sort of respectable right, leaving aside, of course, that our principal audience in many ways were the lawyers of the Obama administration. But that's a creature of the defects of the way the left-right spectrum is understood. This year has really changed that, in the sense that, I think for a lot of people, people use the term Lawfare now in connection with hashtags like resistance, which is not something that we ever say about ourselves, but is a reflection of the arguments that a lot of people associated with the site are now having. And, we have it's a different audience. I don't think what we do has changed. We've always analyzed national security problems in terms of law, and that's what we're doing now. My view is the nature of the problem has changed. On the other hand, I think it's undoubtedly true that the political valence through which people understand what we do has changed a great deal.
Corey, I'd like to ask you, you worked in two different administrations. You also had a very senior advisory role in the McCain campaign as well. But you also found yourself in sort of manning the front on the Never Trump campaign. You signed both the letters. By the way, to those of you who are worried about Republican talent not being able to get into this administration, I will say, as the person that published the first one, you're welcome. And you weren't shy about advocating or making a point that you actually supported Hillary Clinton over Trump, which is a pretty amazing, unusual thing for a Republican to say. How has this changed how you view your role in debates about national security policy?
Oh, so this election was the first time in my life that my sister and I supported the same presidential candidate. And it's a distinctly uncomfortable position for me to be in. I saw Mike Horowitz here, and I had the pleasure of at his Perry World House conference a couple of weeks ago debating Derek Chollet, who is an Obama policy apologist. And both Derek and I were agreeing that we were both homesick for the days where we were adversaries rather than allies. I am serenely unrepentant of my commitment to the belief that the president's unsuited for the office and unfit for it. I, 2 years ago, thought Democrats were wishful thinking when they talked about a civil war on the Republican side. But I do now think that the most important political debate we are having in this country is actually among Republicans, and that those of us who support a liberal international order and a liberal domestic order of limited government and the rule of law actually have a responsibility to win this argument with our own voters. That's the nature of the times that we're in, and we can't shy away from them.
This period has also seen you get much more involved, not just, I mean, you've always written a lot of articles, but now you've gotten a lot of involved in podcasting, a lot, Deep State Radio and other shows that you take part in, including Perry World House's Global Cable, which you should be listening to at Perry World House at Penn. What sort of, do you think there's a relationship between you getting more involved in podcasting and what's been happening politically, or is it just sort of a happy accident?
So for those of you old enough to have seen a movie called The Big Chill about a group of college pals who get back together and everybody's successful with one exception, and William Hurt plays the one exception, who's a radio psychiatrist who broadcasts in the middle of the night. And one of his luridly successful high school college classmates asks him, kind of a passive-aggressive way, how many listeners do you have? And I actually feel like William Hurt with the answer, because he says, I have a small but deeply disturbed following. That's actually how I feel about podcasts. Like, I love the people who listen to them. And the folks who listen to War on the Rocks and who listen to Perry World House and who listen to Deep State Radio are people who care desperately about the issues on which we talk. And the best thing about doing those podcasts is actually the listeners, because they will tweet out any mistake I make because they care desperately about all of us having the right answers. And that's so refreshing in this difficult time for our national political culture, that people who are devoted to the right answer and want to hold all of us accountable to it, that's a really beautiful thing, and I actually find it really motivating in this difficult time.
And Nora, you've had a long career of public engagement as well at CNAS, at RAND, and AU now, and Atlantic Council, but also most significantly writing the Strategic Outpost column with Dave Barno over there. How has this administration changed the sorts of debates you feel you need to get involved in?
It's a great question, and I've been reflecting on that ever since you asked me to be on this panel called The Revenge of the Blob, and I was trying to come up with something nifty, you know, to express the view that I don't think we're having a revenge at all. It does not come naturally to me to be the pessimist on a panel and to be depressed. I know. I'm hoping, Corey, if anybody can find a sunny side to this, it's you, but I think even your good temperament is challenged by these circumstances. You know, what we were part of what we've been talking about all day during the conference is that the people who won this election believe that the post-war, World War II global order that, you know, everybody in the national security community has largely taken for granted for the past 70 years is no longer applicable. right? That is such a profoundly fundamental difference from where we've been and where our broad community, I'm including people in the government and outside of government, but the people who think about do national security for a living, it's so different from where we've been that it raises all sorts of uncomfortable questions about what constitutes policy engagement. How can you have influence in this environment? Particularly, we were talking about this earlier today, in an administration that comes in explicitly rejecting experts and expertise. Right, so it's a really tough challenge. The obvious point is that we don't have as much influence as a community as we used to, because the people on the inside are not looking to outside expertise. But if you go beyond that, I think we have learned as a community that we haven't made our case, those of us who believe in this order. And again, like Corey was saying, I think this has been a bipartisan consensus that most of us overlooked was such a bipartisan consensus while we were arguing about the hows, not the whats. I never thought we'd be questioning the whats. I always thought that hows was the fundamental issue, but it's not, right? And so it's all making all sorts of strange bedfellows now in that sense. I think that we as a community are starting to understand that our case for that global order has not been made outside the Beltway, that we've been talking largely inward and to ourselves, and that we must do a better job if we believe in this, and this is something we want to keep perpetuating, that we must get that message across more broadly in the country as a whole. Now, that's a remarkably difficult task because of all the problems I mentioned earlier, but also because the reason why people are angry at the elites, this goes back to, again, some of our earlier conversations today, the solutions to them, although they affect foreign and national security policy, they don't derive in it, right? The reasons why people, voted for outsiders, voted for people to upend the system, are frustrated with the system, and were attracted to Donald Trump's message are not things we can recommend a national security or a foreign policy fix for. Those are domestic issues, right? The redistribution, growing inequality, people who got a bad deal out of globalization, all of those things. So it's a really tough position to be in. But I think we all now at least understand that we need to make that case better, even if we don't know how to do it yet. I've heard a lot of folks talking after the election about how do you take that message outside of Washington. And some folks are making good efforts at that. Julie Smith, the great Julie Smith at CNAS, has started a project to try to do that. She had a big rollout in Pittsburgh last week, so that's an effort in the right direction, I think. But I think as a community, we're just starting to come to terms with that.
I want to pick up on something very important that you just said, the strange bedfellows element. So as a foreign policy realist, I've been surprised and I would even say unsettled to end up on the same side on the sort of major debates now of people that I vigorously, almost violently, have disagreed with for the last 15 years. And I find that very strange. And I think, do you unite with these people? Is it important to set aside the sort of major differences that you have to present a united front against a problem that might be more important, and something that I struggle with, and it changes issue to issue. But I'm just curious to get your thoughts, and then going down the line.
Yeah, I think that's really important for the main issue, which seems to unite our community. And again, there are people probably who don't subscribe to that. There is a very isolationist view within our community, so I probably shouldn't say everybody agrees with it, but it is certainly the dominant majority view, whatever our other political differences. And again, if you believe, as I do, that has brought the best peace and prosperity to the world, not just to U.S. interests, although for that as well, then I think you have a responsibility to fight for it and to try to make the case, no matter how tough the prevailing headwinds are on it, and no matter how weird the bedfellows, right? When I was thinking about what I was going to say, I wanted to try to say something constructive, and the question that came into my mind was "Что делать?" Right, the question in Russian that Lenin posed: "What is to be done?" Right, at a cosmic level, how do we address this in our community? And I think that there are two things that we can do that are really important. If the goal is to try to promote that order and try to keep the momentum going in that direction as much as we can, the first is to keep writing and teaching. right? Writing is critically important to ensure that, you know, we are still trying to shape the debates however we can, no matter how much a cry in the dark it may seem. If people don't think that, you know, they're being read widely or the right policymakers will be read widely, well, you know, I console myself in my darker moments with at least there's some importance of writing for history, that there were people who wrote and said the right thing. That's not necessarily what's going to get you out of bed every morning to go sit down at your computer, but it is nonetheless a noble goal. And the second thing that I think we need to think about as we look forward and that we have not started to engage in as a community because it's still early days, I mean, it doesn't feel like it in the Trump administration, but it is still early days, is what comes next, right? I talked to a senior member of our field who phrased the question as this: how do we rebuild from the wreckage? Right? If what you believe in is an open global international order, the damage to that is going to be severe. It already has been. It's going to get worse as time goes on. So what comes next? And that's an area where, to plug the journal that has brought us all together here today, you know, that is something that academics can play a very important role in helping set some of the long-term strategic thinking for, that policymakers have an obligation to start thinking about. What comes next for those of us who have this vision, despite the fact that it is unlikely to prevail for the foreseeable future?
So while not disagreeing with anything my friend and scholar I admire enormously, Nora Ben-Sahal, just said, I'm substantially more optimistic than she is.
I'm glad. Tell me why I should be.
Because the liberal international order that the United States created is just a lot more resilient than we're giving it credit for. It has the capacity to sustain itself even after American leadership. If you look at the way that Australia and Japan have committed to sustain the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership without American participation in order to buy us time to right the ship. If you look at the way that the Trump administration, for all of the president's ideological proclivities, has on the major decisions about alliance relations, about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, about the ISIS fight, have taken actually strikingly traditional positions on them when forced to make a decision. I think that actually really shows the resilience of the order. More directly, domestically, I think the shock of President Trump's election has in many ways distracted us from the fact that these are winnable arguments with our fellow Americans. Living west of the Rockies and spending a fair amount of time talking to high school kids and Rotary clubs, people get it if you explain it to them in a way that's meaningful to them. And I really think the fact that the blob has been predominantly taking for granted that we all agree on these issues and not talking respectfully to people who don't agree with us, that's a fixable problem. And I would just offer as the data for that, that I know Josh Busby and other folks among us are also involved with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and they do an annual poll of American attitudes on foreign policy. And what's been really striking is in the last year, on the three major foreign policy issues that President Trump campaigned on, alliances, trade, and immigration, you have seen 15-point swings in public attitudes in opposition to the president's views. And that, in fact, what I think it means, I'd be interested if Jim or Josh or others of you who are knowledgeable on these issues have a different view than I do. What it looks like to me is that what we are seeing is that we're in the midst of a dramatic revolution. Things are changing. Technology's changing. The economy's changing in dramatic ways. People are scared. And political leaders in both political parties have largely abdicated their responsibility to give context to the nature of the change. Again, Philip Zelikow's written a lot about how the economy's changing and how political leaders have failed to grab onto this. Let me just offer that the Peterson Institute for International Trade did a survey that only 15% of American jobs lost in the last 17 years have been lost to trade. 85% of them are lost to innovation and technology change. And yet both political parties had as a central component of their electoral platform opposition to trade. That's the measure of how we as elites and as experts have failed in our responsibility to educate the public and to shape political party attitudes. What it looks like in the Chicago Council data, to me, again, others may have a different view, what it looks to me like is that President Trump is asking important first-order questions. Are our allies taking advantage of us? Is trade causing us to lose jobs? Is it more beneficial to others than it is to us? Is immigration taking jobs away from Americans who are less newly arrived? And that what it looks like in this most recent year's data from the Chicago Council on Global Affairs is that the president asking these questions caused people to get educated on the subject, and they have come to different conclusions than the president. And that's actually how this system is supposed to work. I don't think we ought to be so pessimistic that the American public isn't a winnable constituency for sensible policies on these issues when they are beneficiaries of them. We just need to roll our sleeves up and meet them in the places they're worried about, not the places we're comfortable talking about it.
Because you raise a really important point, is that these are winnable debates. And Trump is actually asking, in his own way, sometimes asking very reasonable questions. And indeed, questions that many of us have asked for a long time. Are our alliances unbalanced? Are these interventions a bad idea? Are these trade deals unbalanced as well? I call these the Trumpertunities, where we can actually have these debates now. I almost wrote this article with Chris Preble, and we both got busy, and we never finished it. Story of almost every article that I've never written. But there's also the Trumptastrophes, is he's actually the worst person in the world to answer these questions, I think. He has the most destructive answers.
By the way, is to the advantage of those of us who believe his answers are wrong. Right? He's the worst person to answer it. He has bad answers to the question. Okay. And yet, I'm a two-thirds convinced that President Trump may actually end up being good for democracy in America. Because, first of all of us are getting an education on obscure civic issues like the Emoluments Clause. Thanks to Ben. Second of all, he's activating the antibodies in American society, civil society and great investigative journalism, and might even be able to eventually shame Republicans in Congress to carrying out their constitutional responsibilities. I grant you that's a great leap, but he at least raises the prospect of it. And the really beautiful thing about the structure of American society and American government is that this is an enormous test of our democracy, and we appear to be passing it.
So I actually want to return to Ryan's original question, which was how we should feel about strange bedfellows, and I don't normally give hortatory speeches, but I want to give one on two points. The first is, keep in your mind the idea that Corey started with at the beginning of this conversation and then quickly lost the thread of, which is...
Come on, man!
No, I'm giving you credit for... You know, and what she said at the beginning was that there's an international order question and there's also a domestic order question. And what I want to say is that those two questions are actually the same question. You believe in a rules-based order and a order in which there are norms that govern the way we interact with one another, or you don't. And there's a state-level component, interstate-level component of that, but there's also a domestic-level component of that. And when you get a bunch of foreign and defense policy people in a room, you have this conversation about the international order conversation, but the first-order question right now is a set of domestic questions. And this is where the strange bedfellows matter an enormous amount. And the reason is that, you know, Nora's exactly right. There is actually a bipartisan consensus traditionally on the international stuff and this liberal international order. And there is not a domestic consensus, or at least that domestic consensus is much more frayed than it is on the international side. And so the first point is, don't let yourself lose the thread of what is happening domestically, because it's an integral part of the larger conversation about the U.S. role in the international space. The second point is, if you think about it that way, it answers the question of how you should feel about the strange bedfellows. The other day, and I'm going to keep one name out of this for reasons of decorum and propriety and historic friendship, but a very dear friend of Corey and mine wrote a simply disgraceful article that was deeply, deeply morally beneath him on the domestic side of some of these questions. And I was spending the day seething about this and trying to figure out how to interact with this person, which I'm still struggling with, to be honest. And I was walking into Brookings thinking about this, and walking out of Brookings was Bill Kristol. And I, like, quite literally, we embraced. And if you told me 2 years ago that I would greet Bill Kristol like a brother while seething about this other person with who has been my co-author, who is a dear, dear friend, I would have told you you'd lost your mind. And what I want to say is, like, actually nothing that Bill Kristol and I disagree about, which are, you know, that's a long list, and I assume he's one of the people that Ryan is talking about as well. Nothing, none of that matters compared to the question of whether you believe in democratic, small d democratic government domestically, whether you believe in a certain level of decency in politics, and a certain level of restraints, things that you will not do in politics due to your political opponents, and in a fundamental internationalism in your conduct of foreign relations and thinking about the rest of the world. Everything else is a rounding error compared to those. And so what I would say is, yeah, notice who the strange bedfellows are and, like, hug them. I think it's a really important thing to imagine that in a domestic context as well as an international context, and to integrate the two.
So I think everyone sitting up here shares lots of things, but one experience is we often spend a lot of time giving advice to younger people who are either in very junior positions in our sort of field, broadly defined, or trying to break in. How has the political events of the last year or so changed the kind of advice that you give to young people?
Yeah, it's a great question. One of the things I am concerned about in the longer term, in addition to all of the shorter to medium term things to be concerned about, is that I think, well, it's demonstrable. Interest in international security, foreign affairs, schools, for example, dropped precipitously after the election of Trump. Right, the number of people who want to do good, who are civically minded in terms of public service, and I am talking now nationally, I'm not Republican, Democrat, I'm just talking about people who are interested in public service, I don't think have a lot of models, role models, or people who are going to be providing a lot of inspiration in the current political scene. So I worry that one of the most pernicious, well, I shouldn't say that, but one of the very pernicious long-term effects is going that we're going to lose a generation of people who might have made this their career and go to something that is safer, making money, working on Wall Street, whatever, who might have been lured into public service and international affairs to begin with. I think that the way you keep motivating the people who are making those choices is to encourage them, is to remind them that this is a noble calling in the field of public service in general, and that no matter how difficult it is, continuing to write and think critically and to be part of the conversation is better than not. even when it seems tough and even when it seems very difficult to do. I think part of the way that you do that is you serve as role models by doing it yourself. I deliberately brought a pen up here onto the panel because most of the people in this room have a pen. Right, they write for War on the Rocks. They, you know, hopefully they're all going to write for the Texas National Security Journal and propel it
That's
to wonderful places.
Invited,
I'll get my, you know, paycheck for the, you know, free political advertising on the side. The people who are, you know, listening to this podcast are involved in public affairs. They have pens. We should be using them. Right? We should be using them to say what's right. And I want to call out Corey in particular because I think, along with Elliot Cohen, they have been some of the two most outspoken folks who have taken their pens and used it for public good, even at perhaps personal expense or friendships and all of that. And I think that is tremendous. So I think part of the way that you continue to serve as a role model is not just continuing to reach out to young people, continuing to mentor them, teaching critical thinking skills, more important than ever today. So those of you who are professors, you know, what you're doing, that alone is a huge contribution. But modeling that behavior by writing and having the kind of civil discourse that we all think is important, continuing to work on these issues, I think, is what still needs to be done more than ever.
What I notice as a school teacher is that there is an enormous wellspring of interest by young people in the issues of war and peace, that there has been a falsity perpetrated that young people aren't interested in international affairs or young people aren't interested in foreign policy news. And the success of Vice is the refutation of that. The success of War on the Rocks is the refutation of that.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I have to, the highest compliment that was ever paid to me, War on the Rocks, is a Hollywood producer who wanted to adapt one of our articles into a TV show, and I knew it would never happen, but it was still an interesting experience to go through. He once said that, here's what I like about War on the Rocks. When I go to Vice, I feel like I'm reading what a guy from Brooklyn thinks about the Middle East. But when I go to War on the Rocks, I feel like I'm eavesdropping on a conversation in a bar in Washington.
Fantastic. That is the right phrase. Just to take one data point, as Ambassador Crocker and I were talking about earlier this evening in Autumn Brewington, the New York Times prides itself on finally getting a business model that can transition to mobile. But New York Times has a Snapchat channel that gets more daily views than the mobile version of the New York Times. It is not that young people aren't interested in these issues. It's that they are not interested in receiving information in the way that the traditional producers of that information are comfortable providing it. And so what we need to do is actually up our game, is find ways as teachers and writers and public communicators to reach the young people who are motivated to change the world and want to be a force for good. And equip them with, as Dr. Bensahel had said, the critical thinking skills and the opportunities professionally where they can do that. There's an enormous opportunity for that. And too few of us are actually taking it by meeting young people in the place they're comfortable being.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, my experience with Lawfare is that everything that I have ever planned in it, where I have said we will do X and the readers will respond Y, was in the Y fashion, was an exercise in self-humiliation and, you know, just sort of realizing the limits of my own ability to predict anything. And when we throw spaghetti at the wall, and
Spaghetti on the Wall Productions.
Well, we even named a production company after the strategy. And when we just try things and let people respond to them and respond ourselves to the stuff that is working, we reach a lot of people, and we reach a lot of people in ways that are pretty profound. And so I wholly endorse Corey's sense that, you know, there's a lot more opportunity to talk to people about issues that matter a lot and that we care about than we can talk ourselves into a degree of paralysis. But in fact, the channels of communication are there, and it's really our job to sort of figure out how to use them in fashions that are helpful and that promote the sort of discussion and debate we want to see happen.
I'm sorry, one more thing I should have said. My ruthless sister is the communications director for Instagram. And what their research shows is that people are thirsting for two things, content and context. And we as experts in this field are uniquely positioned to provide both of those things. We just need to do it in a way that's accessible, that people want to get their hands across, which is why the journal that you all are creating matters so much. It's a vehicle for communication to people who might otherwise not find ways to participate in an intellectually serious and policy-relevant conversation.
So I'm going to call out two people that I haven't actually told that I'm going to do this to, because I just decided to do it, to get their perspective on this debate. One is my buddy John Bew, to give us a sort of British, speaking for all the people of Britain, of course, perspective on all these debates, because obviously Britain's undergoing a major debate of its own with how it's going to handle Brexit. In some ways, the political transformations in Britain and the United States have been compared and discussed, and I wonder if you'd come up here and sort of give some of your reflections, unplanned, on the spot.
Thank you, Ryan. I actually have a question for everyone. There's one thing, which is obviously in civilized European company, we share what's being expressed here, which is basically, without exception today, a sort of collection of horrified opinions about your president. So it's quite striking. I think I've heard one dissenting voice, which leaves America's allies in some of these shared pursuits, whether they be aberrations or noble pursuits, we'll leave that to other people to decide. What do America's friends or allies do in this awkward situation? Because, what do all you Trump critics say about, for the fact that the British Prime Minister, stuck really between a rock and a hard place in the context of Brexit, had to come here and pay homage to your commander-in-chief? I mean, is the job not to do that and to wait it out until something happens thereafter? Because it potentially strengthens the president. What do the allies do, more broadly speaking?
It's a subject on which I have really strong views. Congratulations, John, for dodging. And the first, we have several models of this, right? You have the German chancellor, who has felt the need to both emphasize what have traditionally been common values that she considers the United States in violation of now. And second, to transmit the content of private conversations publicly in order to shore up her own position in them. And you have the British Prime Minister, who is walking holding hands with the president and seemingly almost incapable in most instances of providing any distinction between Britain's position and Americans' position on this. And I think they're both wrong. It seems to me that the best space for America's allies to occupy is to express their confidence in the American public's ability to navigate these difficult times and not position themselves to either be censure or support for it, but to believe that we're all navigating choppy waters, and they have confidence in America's ability to do it, because I think nobody's going to appreciate them intervening in a domestic conversation that either we will succeed at, in which case everybody's going to resent their being taking a side on it, or we will fail at, in which case it won't matter.
It's a really good question, and I don't think there are easy answers for that. I was really struck by the letter that came out a couple of weeks ago now, I guess, by the German foreign policy experts who signed this open letter directed at the German chancellor, but obviously also at a much broader international audience, which essentially said, for the first time, we need an America strategy, because we haven't had to because it's just been assumed, which essentially called for what I thought was from an American perspective. I'm not a German, so I don't know how it played out in a German domestic context, but I thought was offered quite sage advice, which was work with the United States on the issues where there's still shared interest, and there still are those. In the areas where you don't see a lot of hope for progress, read climate change. Don't change your position, but don't make it a high priority either. And my words, not theirs, save your fire for the disagreements that truly matter and take a principled stand on those. And I think that's a reasonable way to be approaching the United States in this time of great transition. I will say, though, that the question of do we wait it out, this was something that was going through my mind in this morning's panel, the one on the global order. I thought that at times on that panel there was, it was implicit, it didn't come out, but a sort of assumption that this will be okay after the next election, or that if, you know, someone else, Republican or Democrat, becomes president, you know, then January 21st, 2021, you know, we'll get back to business and, you know, we'll be, the global order will all be okay. And I think that there is no chance that is going to happen, because whatever happens in the next 4 years, possibly 8 years, but, you know, by tomorrow we'll profoundly change those things. And that's why I think that it is incumbent upon those of us in the United States, but now I would broaden it to the community of thinkers among our allies and partners as well, to start thinking to the extent we can, to start laying the groundwork for what does the day after look like, given the fact that we know that a lot of the things that we hold dear in this global international order will not be the same, will have been somehow fundamentally changed by the actions of this administration. I do agree with you, Corey, that this is a winnable argument with the American people that's going to challenge us to make it and to win it, but I agree that that is doable. But the status quo, we're not going back to the status quo. I'm not saying you said that, but we're not going back to the status quo. So how do we think about when this period passes, whatever that looks like, whenever there's a different president, how do we move forward from there? And again, that's where I think academics in particular can start laying some of the groundwork in terms of, you know, the long-term basic questions about that, that policymakers are, you know, have things to say about, but a lot of the details are going to need to get filled in as we see how the next few years' events develop.
One other quick salvo. The country that I think has gotten it closest to right is Canada, which has not provoked firefights at the federal level, but has worked very quietly and assiduously at the state and city level to find American counterparts to cooperate with. And so, you know, Europeans are rightly upset about the United States withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accords, but the Canadians are working with the governor of California who's prepared to enforce that in the world's fifth largest economy. And that kind of creative work below the federal level to sustain the cooperation that we might not have at the federal level, I think is a really smart strategy.
Well, I'll say that you can explain the Canadian strategy pretty easily for anyone who's ever seen the only good Michael Moore movie, Canadian Bacon, about why they would be acting in a more sort of quiet and subversive manner rather than aggressive manner. But on a serious note, I'll say, I think the country that's actually probably got an ally that's got it most right is Japan. Abe has struck a very good personal relationship with Trump from what we can tell, and has continued on in exactly the direction he wants to continue on in. Ben, do you have anything to add to this?
I'll just say what they said.
I want to go to my friend Will Ruger, sitting right here, and I think he has a comment, question, or a combination of the two.
So I think deep engagers here in Washington, if they want to prevail and educate the people, as Corey talked about, I think they have to answer this question that a Wisconsin or Pennsylvania voter, Western PA voter, is going to ask them, which would be something like this. The Washington foreign policy establishment has told us that we needed to go to Iraq. They fought a war in Iraq. 4,000 Americans died. The place is a disaster. This has sprung ISIS from its font. We fought a good war in Afghanistan. It doesn't seem like it's what we've done since about 2003 is working. We talked about a responsibility to protect in Libya. This has led to multiple governments now in Libya, and arms flowing other places, terrorists flowing in, instability in Mali and other places. We're told that we somehow need to get involved in a fight in Yemen, and we're seeing lots of bad things happening and instability, and the people we're ostensibly trying to help don't seem to be helped. So how should deep engagers and those of us in Washington that want to have a conversation with the country, How do we answer that question about our performance here in Washington?
Yeah, I answer that question 5 times a week. And people are right to ask it, right? There's a reason people are skeptical of elite opinion, and it's the wars we've been fighting since 2001 and the 2008 financial crisis. That is what has delegitimized elite opinion in the country. My answer to the question is, you know, after September 11th, my experience of the political leadership in the United States was they were genuinely scared about all we didn't know about the threats that were engaging. I think even 2 years later, the Bush administration wouldn't have fought the war in Iraq if the circumstances occurred in 2005 or 2006. But after September 11th, people were scared. They wanted to protect Americans against a range of threats they were deeply fearful and not very knowledgeable of. And we didn't do it in a smart way. We did it in a catastrophically costly way for ourselves, but more importantly, for Iraqis. And with the wars in Yemen, in Afghanistan, in Libya, and in Iraq, we are afraid of threats that are emerging from badly governed spaces, right? And that's what those four places have in common, that the stretch of good governance is insufficient for the territory and the people of the country. And creating that is difficult. It fails in most places, not just in those places. And it requires a long-term commitment to create positive change. And we are midstream on the doing that in the places where we're consistently and creatively engaged. In other places like Yemen and Libya, we are not sufficiently engaged to create the kind of change that's going to foster positive practices and good governance in those societies. I would argue ardently, passionately, that more engagement, not less engagement, is what's... Not necessarily more military engagement, but helping shape societies in ways that help them solve their problems is the solution to the things we are scared of. And that's what those four places have in common.
I share that completely, but I would add something to it. It seems to me a very great error to string those failures together. And some of them are more obviously failures than others. But it seems to me if you accept them all as failures and foibles, it is a great error to conclude from that list that you should throw out the premises of the international order generally. One possible set of conclusions for that is that the order should be a little bit less militarily interventionist than it is, but that the Atlantic Alliance remains a wonderful thing that has checked and prevented all sorts of Russian aggression from the East, that the alliances with Japan and South Korea remain essential to, and more generally, that the sort of Pax Americana allows for things like free navigation on the high seas that we just take for granted as a feature of the world that are not in fact self-executing. And so the question is, so you don't like some results that we achieved or failed to achieve over a discrete period of time in the international order, you have to ask yourself the question, what is baby and what is bathwater here? And the premises of the Trump administration is that the alliances themselves suck, that international trade is a matter of countries fleecing the United States for wealth that we would otherwise be distributing gleefully in the form of high-paying jobs, and that foreigners should never come to the United States. These are not premises that flow logically or reasonably from the fact that the Iraq War, in retrospect and maybe prospectively at the time, was certainly the wrong thing to do. And I think it's really important that we not allow people easily
to draw the, I mean, it's their decision whether those are conclusions that they want to accept. But we shouldn't acquiesce to the reasonableness of those conclusions just because somebody insists on them over and over again.
I think that's a good place to end it, but I'll just say one thing, is I shared a lot of the skepticism of that notional voter. But I would put Iraq and Libya in one category and Afghanistan and Yemen in a very different category. In Iraq and Libya, you had established political orders that we took active steps to overthrow. In Iraq's case, obviously, much more active steps to overthrow. Afghanistan and Yemen were very partially and largely ungoverned spaces that we got involved in Afghanistan, especially over the longer term. But the problem is I'm well established as a non-interventionist in many different cases, but not intervening also doesn't solve the problems of those places that those places present for U.S. security. But that's a longer conversation. I'm going to end it right there.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, and this week in cooperation with War on the Rocks, whom we thank for providing us the audio of this event. Congratulations to the Texas National Security Journal on its launch. You all need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. Tweet about it. Share it on Facebook. Talk about it annoyingly at parties. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan, who says, give the Lawfare Podcast a 5-star rating on iTunes. What's the matter with you? And get a friend to do it, too. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.